The following interview is a fascinating and long one, so we've broken it into two parts and released those parts one day apart. Please be sure to listen to part one, which was released yesterday, before listening to today's episode. This series discusses homicide and serial murder. Listener discretion is advised. This is The Fall Line. Last time, we introduced you to Enzo Yaksik. He's the author of Killer Data: Modern Perspectives on Serial Murder. Enzo is also the founder and director of the Atypical Homicide Research Group and one of the data scientists contributing to the incredibly important work at MAP, the Murder Accountability Project. We've highlighted the work of MAP before. If you'd like to learn more, you can listen to our episode entitled Mapping Murder. Last episode, Enzo walked us through some of the findings he's presented in Killer Data, a book I suggest to anyone with an interest in understanding the true state of atypical homicide and serial murder in the United States. In part one of this interview, we covered some major cultural myths regarding the, quote, average serial killer, what has skewed our perceptions of serial killers, like narrow studies and limit of scope, and what typology the field has moved beyond, like the concept of an organized versus disorganized killer. In this half, we pick up with our discussion of the concept of the genius serial killer. If you've seen Silence of the Lambs, you know exactly who I mean, the archetypal clever murderer playing the long game with law enforcement. While the figures we're presented with in real life aren't precisely Hannibal Lecter-level geniuses, we're given something in that realm. The idea that, in a game of cat and mouse, a long-term serial killer lasts because he can outplay investigators. So, I think I told you a little bit about this when we first spoke, but our show exclusively focuses on cold cases and communities that receive fewer resources and attention, and we're talking investigatively, scholarly, journalistically, etc. So mainstream serial killer research has not been much use to us. We began our work covering the unmatched confessions and unidentified Jane Doe cases related to Samuel Little. One thing that you talk about in Killer Data is something that we discussed in our series. So that was really exciting for me to read, which was the myth of the all-powerful, genius serial killer, able to evade and outsmart. And we found in Little's case, he killed for decades because he murdered women in the margins and women whose families had a harder time attracting help from law enforcement. And that's something that you talk about in your book in regard to the concept of longevity, and relatedly, the concept of luck. Can you speak more about that and how longevity has shifted now in the 21st century?
Yeah, absolutely. As a matter of fact, one of our recent academic studies did attempt to get at the issue of success among serial murderers and what factors led some of them to have long careers. We named that longevity. So what we found was that offenders, their criminal history, their race, victims who were of minority backgrounds, taken together, significantly predicted a longer duration in the murder series, alongside a combination of multiple killing methods used, such as switching out from a gun to a knife over their series, and atypical methods, hanging, drowning, also predicted longer murder series. But this doesn't mean that the offender intentionally engaged in these behaviors to disrupt or hamper police investigations. While an offender with a criminal history might have been or might be more sophisticated and therefore better equipped to avoid detection, they still do benefit from factors that are definitely outside of their control, such as the amount of resources available to police and their overall level of interest in even resolving the cases as expeditiously as they should. So, Mr. Little was not necessarily an exceptionally skilled killer. He honestly lucked out by being attracted to the type of victim who was categorically ignored by law enforcement at the time. Little's choice of victim was not necessarily intentional in that the victims who happened into his orbit would not have been in the same pool as someone like Bundy. Their shared geography meant that Little actually did not have to work as hard to ensure their isolation. They tended to run in the same circles, as so to speak. I think the point is that serial murderers often benefit from systemic factors unknown to them and outside of their control. Without interrogating those societal constructs like racism or other biases among police, it would appear that some serial murderers are the, quote, cream of the crop, as I have heard some academics actually refer to them when compared to one-off killers who only kill one victim. The 21st century has seen what we call an unprecedented explosion in technology, namely the location tracking software in our cell phones and surveillance cameras. So for a serial murderer to continuously evade these tracking mechanisms without being captured by geotag requires much more than just skill. The idea that luck plays a role in serial killings is sort of unpopular, given that it runs directly counter to the longstanding belief that these offenders are expert killing machines, able to remain 10 steps ahead of law enforcement, which is pretty much how we like to think of them when we think of them in the entertainment media, that they're always going to outwit police. But that myth was partly engineered by the police themselves to offer an explanation as to why serial murderers are just too difficult to catch early on in their careers. If you take the 20 longest careers of serial murderers, you'll find often several instances where an offender got very lucky across their series and should have been caught. And for example, that might look like a potential witness who ignored screams in the neighborhood because they thought they came from playing kids, a victim who forgot to tell anyone where they were going that night, police who miscataloged or lost a key piece of evidence, an offender being sentenced lightly for a serious crime, or another offender being arrested for the death of one of the serial murderer's victims. And all of these things have actually happened. And so the concept of luck diminishes the sense of control that we have over our situation. And true crime definitely seeds women the notion that they can avoid being a victim if they take the appropriate steps. But serial murderers that get lucky in their random choice of the quote unquote perfect victim and then getting away with that homicide for whatever reason means that there is little that could have been done to stop that particular crime.
You mention in your book that traditionally, organized crime and gang-related violence, which maybe should be one category, are not included in discussions of serial murder. What's your perspective on that choice in terms of understanding homicide in this country?
Okay, so one thing I think is important to understand is that academics love to categorize things and place them into specific buckets. So when it comes to urban violence and organized crime, criminologists have traditionally maintained that even though gang members and mob enforcers often do commit violence serially, these offenders should be excluded from consideration for the rank of serial killer. Now, what's important to know is that this decision harkens back to the way that serial murderers were defined for decades, and that they needed to have been psychologically and or sexually placated by the murders and received no other benefits such as financial incentives. These things were often baked directly into the definitions as they stood back then. So critics of Killer Data's inclusive approach claim that by expanding the serial murder definition to include all types of motives, it would obscure the true profile of these offenders while also artificially increasing prevalence estimates. In fact, considering any offender who kills at least twice for any reason over any amount of times has allowed for a closer examination of their means and motives, more so than simply placing a label on sex offending repeat murderers. So even when we incorporate offenders on the lower boundaries of the victim threshold, such as killers who kill, quote, only two victims, the decline in serial murder is still overwhelmingly apparent. So this goes counter to the arguments that are against this expansive viewpoint. So another reason why academics have excluded these types of offenders is the elusiveness of what goes on between two or more offenders, something they refer to as group dynamics. So their reasoning is that it can be difficult enough to try to understand why one offender does what he or she does, let alone two or more killers who are operating together. Criminologists also do not like to lump offenders who take orders from others in with offenders who choose to kill on their own volition. But after all, at one time, the idea that serial murderers should be self-motivated was actually part of the definition. As I've demonstrated throughout our conversation, early academics were a bit restrictive in how they looked at this phenomenon.
So you just mentioned the decline of serial murder in the current age. And that's something that I've seen you mention a few different times in a few different places. And it's one of the reasons I wanted to read your book. And I'm so glad that I did. When you talk about decline of serial murder in the current age and your views on why the true crime industry and perhaps even some law enforcement haven't acknowledged this, I'd love to hear you expand on that a bit.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the decline idea is something I've staked my career on, and not a lot of people have accepted the fact that it's actually occurring. But if you ask anyone to name a recent serial murderer, you might hear names like Anthony Sowell or Israel Keyes offered as examples of offenders who flew under the radar of authorities and committed their crimes pretty much in secret. But although these cases concluded in 2009 and 12, respectively, many believe that there are hordes of similar offenders operating in the shadows today, just waiting to be found. But these particular offenders are popular because people tend to remember serial murder cases that have a unique component, such as a killer who warehouses their victims' remains, like Sowell did, or buries weapon caches around the country, like Israel Keyes did. But it is precisely the uniqueness of these cases that should keep them from being heralded as the typical example of the everyday serial murderer. So the fact remains that through judicious tracking, over the past 9 months of 2022, there have been only 19 cases of serial murder in the U.S., or basically what translates to two offenders captured every month. 14 of these cases occurred over mere hours or days, two of them taking place over the span of only a week. Some might refer to these offenders as spree killers. Three other cases transpired over 3 months each, while only two offenders killed over the span of a year or more. So aside from a mere 16 offenders killing over 2019, this year is shaping up to end with the lowest number of serial murderers on the record over the past decade. Even if another six offenders were caught over the next month to close out the year, resulting in 25 serial murderers captured over 2022, those numbers are still far lower than the 45 offenders found in 2011 or the 54 offenders found in 2012. And if we go back to the 80s, there were hundreds of offenders that were captured over that decade. So longevity among serial murderers has been greatly impacted by things such as better connected law enforcement agencies, vigilant public, and the ever presence of technology such as cell phones and surveillance cameras, each of which we just saw help in the Stockton case to capture that offender. So offenders who may have killed over a number of years in the past have been forced to kill in quick bursts, which has definitely increased the likelihood of mistakes and their capture. My work on potential serial murderers demonstrates that there are still people out there who wish to become serial murderers, of course, but they cannot seem to string together enough homicides to meet the minimum criteria to earn the rank of serial killer. One recent example of this is Joshua Ross McCuller, who had fantasies of becoming a serial killer, which included strangulation, necrophilia, and mutilation of women. He even had a slaughter room in his apartment equipped with numerous cutting instruments and tools and saws, but he just gave himself up after one homicide. So what's important to note about the decline concept is that it does not imply that the incidence of serial murder has completely ceased, as many of its detractors have claimed. The decline simply compares the overall number of apprehended serial murderers to those captured in previous decades. So after a steady decline over the past several years, we're beginning to level off with an average of about 25 serial murderers apprehended each year. One of the reasons the decline in serial murder is overlooked is the preponderance of people with TikTok accounts and social media influencers who jump to hasty conclusions when two homicides share even the most remote possibility of being connected. So if one were to consult these stories, it might appear as if there are a great number of serial murderers in society compared to the number that there actually are. The last thing I want to say on this is detractors of the phenomenon of the decline in serial murder believe that because modern-day serial murderers are, they think, far too savvy and smart to be apprehended, the decline represents a deficit on our part to see offenders who are operating within what they call the dark figure of crime. The idea is that since there are thousands of unresolved homicides in the U.S., a large portion of them must be committed by sophisticated serial murderers. I mean, that makes some sort of sense. But this notion can be disputed, at least anecdotally, with the results of a tool which has gained recent popularity due to its use in resolving the Bear Brook homicides, which, of course, I'm talking about genetic genealogy. So the great majority of homicides that are unearthed due to genetic genealogy have been one-off killers, surprisingly, murderers who kill once and never again.
You mentioned the number of serial killers who've been apprehended in the 80s and 90s, and the numbers were in the hundreds. But even that, to me, sounded low, just based on the way it was presented in the media when I was a child. So it immediately makes me think about whether the number and the prevalence has always been inaccurate in some ways. And if it has, can you expand on that? Has the number of serial murderers in the United States always been exaggerated? And if so, I'm assuming that you have an idea as to why.
Yes, actually it has. The prevalence of serial murder has been purposely exaggerated for actually decades. So academics, I mean, you know, I'm one as well. We need to feel as if what we're working on is cutting edge. So this explains why so many former serial murder researchers have actually started to pivot to studying mass murder. So there's a real belief in the old adage of if it bleeds, it leads, that the news media still abides by. Streaming services continually release documentaries and movies about golden age serial murderers, such as Ted Bundy and Jeffrey Dahmer, as I've mentioned, precisely for this reason. Modern day serial murderers are just not as interesting as the offenders everyone is familiar with. But a byproduct of this behavior is the sense that these particular types of killers never truly disappeared and are still out there lurking around every corner. So it's in everyone's interest who is involved in this area to keep people convinced of the looming threat that serial killers pose, even though they are much rarer now than they have ever been in history. What actually complicates prevalent estimates is the unknown proportion of missing persons cases that result in wrongful death and the number of unresolved homicides that can be linked to serial murderers. The general rule in homicide investigations is to not immediately leap to the possibility of a serial murderer operating in the community whenever a homicide occurs. But in today's day and age, bloggers and journalists attempt to make linkages unsupported by the evidence. This results in credence being given to wild, unproven theories like the smiley face killer, which is all it takes today to convince the public that a serial murderer is on the loose. One of the biggest myths out there is that every serial murderer dismembers their victims. So whenever dismembered remains are found, the first thought is that a serial killer is responsible, even though plenty of one-off murderers engage in this behavior. And it could be said that some individuals in society are actually upset that serial murder has declined, as these cases offered fodder to engage in the case as an armchair detective and try to work out the mystery in real time along with the police.
Yeah, we learned also from our conversation with Thomas Hargrove last year from Murder Accountability Project that while a hotspot on a map in a certain city that can indicate serial murder, it can also just be a totally false signal and represent layered issues like low case clearance. Is that something that you see as one of the issues that's clouding an accurate sense of how many serial murderers are actually operating now in the 2020s?
Actually, it's precisely this issue, which is basing prevalence estimates on faulty or questionable data, that has led to claims that 2,000 serial murderers are active in the U.S. right now. Another representative of MAP has actually stated publicly that the prevalence of serial murder could be as high as 4,000 offenders. So in the instance of our work with MAP, the algorithm is actually built to search for clusters of victims who were killed using the same method and dumped within a tight geographic area. And the algorithm itself was built using the Green River killer, Gary Ridgway, as the model, which explains why it expects serial murder victims to be located in clusters, given that's how he buried his victims. But that aspect is unique to the Green River case. Few other serial murderers have actually behaved in that manner. Another issue is that not all serial murderers use the same method to kill their victims. The third issue is something We have been calling in-house the data train wreck. This refers to the changeover from the SHR, or Supplementary Homicide Reporting System, to something called NIBRS, or the National Incident-Based Reporting System. We at MAP use the SHR to locate clusters of victims, something that will actually not be available for the foreseeable future due to most states experiencing significant NIBRS compliance issues. Some departments refuse to comply at all.
The SHR and NIBRS changeover that Enzo mentions here is something we discussed with Murder Accountability Project founder Thomas Hargrove. Hargrove was pleased about the advent of the NIBRS system when we spoke. He told us that, quote, "The Murder Accountability Project is solidly in favor of the NIBRS standard. It's a very good idea. It provides a wealth of information about all of the index crimes counted in the Uniform Crime Report. We absolutely recommend to all law enforcement agencies to work to adapt to this new reporting standard, which is much more complex and much more complete in the amount of information they have to report every year." He also told us, quote, "The data collected is essentially the level of detail that we've been getting through the Supplemental Homicide Report for all major crimes, for robberies, burglaries, sexual assault, in that it's supposed to name the age, race, gender, ethnicity of every victim. And if an arrest is made, similar demographic information about offenders' weapons used, if any weapons were used, dollar amounts, and value of property stolen. Anyway, a wealth of information at the individual case level. It is a large amount of information that police are being asked to provide the federal government." End quote. So, why the switchover? As Hargrove points out, our understanding is that NIBRS allows for, and thus seems to require, more detail at the incident level. That can disincentivize reporting. Enzo explained another reason why it's so important to have a better cultural understanding of the actual prevalence of serial murder in our society, the families of the missing, and how they're affected by rumors that spread online.
A situation that recently occurred in Kansas City, Missouri, demonstrates how hurtful it can be to families struggling with the unknown when rumors of an active serial murderer are passed around. Even though the claims are unfounded, according to police, the family of a missing teen are being inundated with internet URLs from a community that's convinced by a TikTok video that a serial killer took their daughter. The family themselves have since begged those individuals who are spreading the rumors to just stop. So I think we need to be more selective about the comments we make in regard to the presence of serial murderers, given how inflammatory of a topic it can still be in society today.
So I think I told you when I first contacted you, and this is not just because I wanted an interview, that when I read your book, I was taking notes on every single page. And if I was still in the classroom, I would assign killer data to all of my students before they approached any project based on true crime. I feel like it is such a necessary text. So I would love to know from you, like, just best case scenario, what would you like readers to take away from killer data? What do you want them to understand about serial murder, about victims, about statistics, about the reality of crime, anything you want? And also, let me add in here that they still need to buy it and read it, right? I just, just an overall message.
Well, thank you, Laura, for saying all that. So as the serial murder entertainment complex, as I call it, continues to grow unabated, I feel like it's probably the right time to reevaluate where we are in the realm of serial murder research. So many books have been written that just regurgitate ideas from the past, and I think it's time to just move in, honestly, into the 21st century. So my recent Medium piece about accountability in true crime is probably unlikely to make a difference in the wider conversation that's actually going on that was spurred from the Ryan Murphy show about Jeffrey Dahmer. But it is interesting to me just how many opportunities there were for me to post about it on social media as a response to people who are honestly obsessed with the true crime genre, diehard fans. Yeah, you can't say anything against it to those folks. But I suppose the take-home message of killer data is that we, I think, need to take a step back from the serial murder genre and ask ourselves if this is where we thought that we would be 50 years on from acknowledging their appearance in modern-day society. I think we need to understand that serial murderers definitely do not fit one particular archetype or mold, and they are rarely the seething, unhinged, mentally ill monster lurking in the alleyway, as they are often portrayed. But even modern portrayals are a bit inaccurate, as they are also not usually the outgoing neighbor that everyone loves and who people are shocked to see arrested. The truth is somewhere in the middle. So the point of Killer Data is to stand as a wake-up call that we need to begin deconstructing what we think a serial murderer is in the modern age. So I think, personally, it would be foolish to abide by old thinking or to carry those traditional viewpoints into the next generation. So as times change, so does the landscape of offending, and Killer Data, I hope, will stand as, you know, one of the first efforts to really wake up folks and bring them into the 21st century. To me, it's the most important to reach academics that are just starting their careers, and I hope that Killer Data can serve to them as Eric Hickey's work did for me. I carried that book everywhere. It was my Bible. He's been my mentor, and I can't thank him enough. I would definitely not be here if it wasn't for him. So anybody listening that wants to reach out to me, please do so. I will help anyone that wants my help. I've mentored a few people already, so please reach out to me if you have the desire to become a serial murderer researcher, a serious serial murderer researcher.
Yeah, I think the word serious is important.
Yeah.
We thank Enzo Jaksik for taking time to speak with us on these issues. Understanding more about serial murder and the victims of these crimes helps us consume media more responsibly and ethically, operate on social media more responsibly, and look at our criminal justice system with a more educated and critical eye. It can also help us avoid taking self-proclaimed experts at face value. With more understanding of the reality of atypical homicide, we can see who is simply profiting from what some critics call the true crime industrial complex, and who is working to support victims and survivors and to educate. Please remember, Enzo Jaksik plans to donate the proceeds of his book so you can feel good about reading Killer Data on multiple levels. You'll be supporting a good cause and supporting research. Be sure to check out Killer Data. There's a link in our show notes. And if you know a case that should be featured on the Fall Line, there's a link in our show notes too. We wanted to note that we have recently remastered and re-released season 2 of the show, which covers the disappearances of Monica and Michael Bennett. We're slowly working our way through our back catalog, and those are now complete. They're still in the usual place in the feed, so you can find them in the 2017 releases. Now we have a piece of good news to share. Other podcasting friends joined us a few weeks ago in donating merchandise to Arlene Harpison's Justice for Leon Lorelis Fund. She's raising money for an attorney to help her with various aspects of Leon's case. The True Crime Podcast Festival donated 2 VIP tickets and a hotel stay at their Austin 2023 event. Haley Gray Research organized the merchandise auction, and we all managed to raise several hundred dollars for the fund. And Arlene had more good news. She was thrilled to have her family grant application funded by Season of Justice, who just paid for a billboard for Leon in Brownwood, Texas, where he was murdered on May 10, 1996. It's a small town, and this billboard is in a central area. Arlene feels it could be huge for his case. Another family whose case has been featured on the Fall Line, the daughters of Nut Pham and Jackie Nguyen, have just had a billboard funded by Season of Justice 2 in Birmingham, Alabama. We continue to send families to Season of Justice and hope that we can report back with more campaign news soon. We're really grateful to have this resource to share, and we want to tell you a little bit more about the opportunity for families who are listening or podcasters who are currently working with families. We enthusiastically support this work and want to help them spread the word as far as we can. Season of Justice's Family Grant provides funds for awareness campaigns for families who are seeking answers in their loved one's unsolved violent crime. Their application and program is open to immediate family members of victims of unsolved homicides, violent crimes, and cold missing persons cases. In 2022, Season of Justice funded 10 awareness campaigns consisting of billboards, targeted mobile ads, radio spots, and direct mail campaigns. They currently have billboards up in Louisiana, Texas, Florida, Michigan, Alabama, Pennsylvania, and, as of November 20th, in California. We do want to note that the family grant application is closed for the rest of the year, but will resume in January 2023, and we will remind you when it opens. The Fall Line is an independently produced show, and we appreciate listener support. It allows us to do research, obtain FOIA, pay our content advisors, and support and donate to the causes we care about. If you try out the products we advertise, please use our sponsor codes. It really helps. And if you'd like to support the show and the stories we cover, join us on Patreon. We're raising Patreon funds to continue to pay for the Millbrook Twins billboard and to fund therapy for families who've been on the show. Each and every one of our patrons helps us to continue this work, and we're grateful for your help. On Patreon, you can get early release, ad-free versions of our regular episodes for $5 a month. We've also added occasional video live streams and blog updates, which all patrons can enjoy starting at just a dollar. If you prefer Apple Premium, we've begun that feed as well, so you have an alternative way to contribute. The Fall Line is written, hosted, and researched by Laura Norton, with additional research by Brian Waters, Kiana Burgess, and Michaela Morrill. Interviews by Brooke Hargrove. Produced, engineered, and scored by Maura Curry. Content advisement by Brandy C. Williams, Liv Fallon, and Vic Kennedy. And, as always, our most special thanks to Angie Dodd, Liz Lipka, and Sarah Turney. As of November 2022, our monthly donation is going to Season of Justice to support their testing and family grant initiatives.